Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and...
Jake
McClure. I'm always lost as to what to say at this point.
Nothing. We should just have dead air. Forget this radio business.
Dead air. Dead air. Anyway, this is The Personal Wealth Coach, and The Personal Wealth Coach is not just the name of this Saturday morning radio program, the first of 2019, where it is the 5th of January where we are. And it is also the name of an SEC registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas. And that's not a coincidence, because the same two guys that you hear on here, Jeff and
Jake,
see, we can do that really well
sometimes,
are also the two guys who give investment advice principally at the firm in Salado. So that's not a coincidence. But this is not investment advice. What we're providing on this radio program is educational information, factual information. And we love it if you give us a call in here at 254-773-1400 with your questions or thoughts or comments about anything to do with the economy or market. Do not, at risk of your mental health, contact us about anything that has to do with team sports, because the depth of our ignorance is unplumbable, and were it to be opened up, it could create a black hole that could suck the entire universe down into a sports ignorance negative zone that would be devastating to the economy.
Yeah, the event horizon would be far enough out that we might lose the planet. That is the sucking imbecility of our sports knowledge.
Now, the closest we ever get to understanding sports is the fact that we have read numerous studies, or at least several studies, that point out that opening up a big sports franchise in a city and putting a big stadium in and giving lots of money to the sports team doesn't produce any positive economic benefits.
No, but it does entertain a lot of people.
Right. That makes them feel better about themselves.
Yeah, and that might be a benefit in itself.
Oh, yeah, I mean, obviously it is.
It's being done, and people are still spending money on it, so it must be worth it somehow.
And the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400 if you'd like to join with us. And we already have a caller in there, so caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Oh, that same caller calls frequently.
Yeah, it's like a voice recognition thing.
Well, anyway, the markets were up. The S&P 500 was up 1.86% this week, closed at 2531.94, which is cool. It was up the previous week. I mean, obviously, we're in the middle of a bull market, and the thing has been rising, and everything is exciting.
Only if you look a very short distance.
Yeah, well, actually,
look a little further.
For the last 3 months, it's down 12.26%. It's down 13.6% from its high back in September, and the year closed out, 2018 closed out down 7.70%, which meant that despite the fact we got one of the larger tax cuts, I think the eighth largest tax cut, depends on how you measure it, and the largest corporate tax cut in U.S. history, we got a 22% rise in earnings during the year, largely from the tax cut, and the market went down 7.7%. Now, that sounds like it is contradictory. It's really not once you dig into it. And it's caused a lot of things to go on, but that's what's going on with the market. Very interestingly, the other market, the bond market, has got a kink in its get-along. The short-term rates, which the Fed has set between 2.25 and 2.5, are actually running along at 2.37 right now. That's the interbank lending rate at 2.375, actually. But the 10-year Treasury is only at 2.662. That's only 29 basis points, 29 hundredths of 1% above the short-term. And there's a section in there that basically at 2 years, normally the interest rates are higher than they are in the interbank rate, but they're identical now.
Right. The interbank being very, very short term, and 2 years is 2 years longer than that very short term.
But once we get beyond 2 years, out to about 4 years, interest rates are actually lower than they are in the very, very short term, which is a kink in the get-along.
It kind of looks like a wave.
And it's an upside-down wave.
There's a trough in the middle of the curve, which is weird.
Well,
it's happened before. It's just weird.
And it makes some sense out of this esoteric stuff called yield curving. When the yield, in this case for the 4-year Treasury, is lower than it is for the extremely short-term interbank zero, overnight treasury, in effect, then what you have is the participants in the bond market, who we refer to as the bond market, forecasting that somewhere between 2 and 5 years from now, interest rates will be lower than they are today. And that means they're basically, the bond market is anticipating a recession about 2 years from now.
Right. Sometime between 2 and 5 years from now, they're saying there's a recession coming. And it's a long ways out. 2 years, not as long as some would like, but I was looking at bear markets, because we have these charts on bear markets, and they generally happen about every 3 to 5 years. And there's been this pretty consistent for the past 40 years. Every 3 to 5 years, we have a bear market,
mm-hmm.
except that we're working on 10 years.
It's 9.5 years now.
We're working on the final part of that to 10 years without a bear market.
Yeah, we've been bearless.
And
barely.
We have not had a runaway bull market. And I see that the runaway bull markets hit the bear. I'm like, well, this isn't like the 1980s or even parts of the 1990s. We didn't have a runaway bull market. We had a very slow bull market, very slow compared
more
to
like
many others.
More like an oxen.
Right. And part of that has to do with demographics. Part of that has to do with after the recession, we didn't pick up the jobs very quickly. It was a very slow process to get to where we are. But we've got 99 straight months of job growth.
Is that a song?
It should be. I think it should be a country song. Only it's not sad
99
enough.
Months of job growth on we the wall.
Have,
99 months of
it's
job
gotta,
growth.
It's got to end with a sad note, or you can't. You can't
take
really
one down. Be,
yeah,
pass it around.
It's not going to sell if it's a happy song.
Anyway, what he's saying is right. We've had this amazing length of expansion. The height of the expansion has not busted any records, but the length has been slow and steady, and we've gotten very, very used to the fact that we don't even have corrections. Last one we had, I think it was in 2015, and it really just barely made it into correction.
Just like
for
one day, yeah.
And now we're having a correction, and corrections in the stock market are when the stock market drops at least 10%, but less than 20%, and that is unofficial, but is widely held, so we accept it as a common law
definition,
and it works, since market prices tend to be pretty psychological. And I think this is Jeff speaking. I presume Jake's going to agree with me, but he doesn't have to. This is exactly what this is. It is a correction, not a bear market. The reason I say that, I went back and looked at all the bear markets, and in a bear market, the economy sags, the market keeps on going up, thinking, that economic stuff, it'll come, it'll turn back around again. And then it's kind of like Wile E. Coyote who runs out over the edge of
Someone says yipe, either with a sign or in vocal.
Yeah, and he looks down and there's nothing underneath him and he falls. Well, that's a bear market, but it's probably a bear at the bottom of the mesa. You just never see it.
Right. What we have right now is we're not having sagging economic data. What we have is slowing economic data. It's not going backwards. We're not shrinking. In fact, we're still growing. The fact that unemployment, we just had a jobs report.
312 new jobs. 312,000 new jobs.
Yeah, I was going to say 312 new jobs. That's it.
That's
like
counted
one
thousands.
Employer.
312,000 new jobs created in December. They weren't there before.
And that's seasonally adjusted. So that is already set to adjust for the increase in labor during Christmas. They pull that out. Seasonally adjusting is one of those issues that they're trying to make it regular across the board. But in the process, they also upgraded the previous mm-hmm. 2 months' numbers on jobs. So the numbers that we were a little bit disappointed with come back now looking pretty good, all going back for a whole quarter. We had absolutely record-breaking Christmas, and I've been saying this is the retail side. This isn't even in the online.
In the manufacturing area, we did a big one, too.
The retail side, brick and mortar, had more sales this year, this last Christmas, mm-hmm. then at the height of retail, at the height of the mall is king.
Well, that means we're in a boom. And it makes sense. The numbers out there. By the way, on the manufacturing side, which I focus on a little more consistently, we created 284,000 new jobs in 2018. That's an estimate because the Commerce Department is, by the way, shut down. So we don't know the precise data on this. We actually won't for several months anyway.
Labor Department's open. Commerce Department's not.
But oddly enough, the Labor Department doesn't tell us how many new jobs are created in manufacturing, which
right.
is weird.
They say overall this is the number of jobs created, but if you want specifics, go to another department.
The point is that we have an economy that is healthy. It is growing. The Manufacturing Purchase Managers Index, which is PMI, which is pretty critical. Dropped from 59 to 54, which is, by the way, it's its largest drop since they have been tracking the thing in a single month.
But it's still expansion. Over 50
right.
is growth.
So we've got a growing economy. The growth is slowing. I mean, this is a consistent picture. We seem to have peaked in our growth rate in September and October, which is very consistent with what the market indicated.
It's consistent with what we were expecting based on
right.
limiters. You can't grow faster than that, and effectively, you've now packed the system. This is one of those crazy things. And let me just throw in this side example, and then we'll go right back to that. Traffic. What does traffic have to do with anything? Well, if you're driving through Austin at rush hour, it's going to take you a long time to get through Austin. It doesn't matter which route you take, whichever way you go, it's going to take you a long time to get through there. And it's because there's a lot of cars on the road. You could move that number of cars much, much faster if you could control the timing of the flow. That seems like a pretty obvious statement, but it's coming in bursts. And the growth that we had came in bursts. So if we had a smooth growth during this time period, we would have been able to utilize the highway system to keep a good stream flowing through it. But because our growth comes in bursts, it gets log jams. And that's what traffic jams are. These log jams of all of everybody's trying to grow quickly at the same time, and they clog up the whole infrastructure. Everything from truck driving to railroads to basically any type of shipment that you would get from one side of the country to another or across the world is clogged right now. And that not just puts a damper on growth. Eventually, if we don't get the clogs unclogged, we get a slowdown.
And
that's what we've been worried about for a long time. And I think what we're seeing, there's enough worry about that now that we'll either get a unclogging or we'll have the slowdown in about a year.
There's a significant indicator that popped up this week that would tell us that probably 2019 is going to do okay, but 2020 is going to be really bumpy. 2019, and by the way, the Fed has taken the position, as has S&P and Moody's, and when they all agree on something, that kind of indicates that
it's a pretty good likelihood
that GDP will be around 3% this year. It'll drop into the twos early next year and then continue to drop so that by the end of next year, by the fourth quarter of next year, we'll see an annualized GDP growth running around 1%, which is a really loud signal that that our growth rate is slowing and we have hit capacity.
You said there's a consensus for 2019 at 3%?
I'm sorry, 2018.
You said this year. You haven't updated with your calendar.
Right, I haven't.
3% is the expectation for 2018, and it's going to be likely the end of 2019 we'll be seeing last quarter a much slower growth rate, but we're still seeing growth there.
The very significant thing came out from the Richmond Federal Reserve District. It's the fifth district if you want to keep up with this thing. Their composite manufacturing index fell to -8 in December from a positive 14 in November. Now, I realize those are weird numbers, but the economists expected a reading of 15, and they got a -8. The capital expenditures, and here's a big one. This is just in the Richmond district of the Federal Reserve. It's the fifth district. It's only a piece of the pie, but it is that area in the central south, central east side of the southern states where traditionally we have a lot of good economic manufacturing activity. And it fell to a minus 25. And that is a powerful indicator, as we've said before, that a year or so from now, once capital expenditures start collapsing, it doesn't have an immediate effect.
Well, first, let's say, what is capital expenditure? What is a capital expenditure?
A capital expenditure is something that a company builds or buys that's going to last a long time. A big piece of manufacturing equipment, a new building.
Something that is designed to be profitable.
Right.
That's the important part. A capital expenditure is something that is part of the core business that's designed to create something from which they expect a profit.
It is, in essence, an investment by businesses, and that means that they expect to have more business in the future. And for those of you who listened to us for a long time, back in the 2009, 2010, 2012, right through that time period, we kept noting that the capital expenditures were rising steadily. And that meant we were coming out of this thing and we were looking forward to a much better future, and we got the better future. The reverse is true when you hit the top and the capital expenditures fall from a positive number to a negative 25. That's a big deal. And why is it important? Well, the Federal Reserve bank in Richmond asked for comments from the people who were in the survey, the big chief financial officers and so on, and they said there were two big issues. Number one, they can't find qualified employees to operate the new stuff or
right.
to work in the new factories.
That's
if they were to
one.
Build them, so they're not going to build them. Three things. Two, if they built more things and they manufactured more things, they're in the position where there's no way they could get them to the customer or get the raw materials to them because the transportation system is jammed, as Jake was saying. And last but not least, they are scared silly. And this was, I looking at the numbers, it's amazing how frightened they are of the threat. Well, they're frightened of 25% tariffs. And one of the reasons they're frightened, they have dropped the idea that President Trump doesn't mean it.
Yeah, they believe him now.
Because the government shut down. And the idea that the government could stay shut down for a long period of time, and they depend upon the government for certain things.
Right.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. You know, there's a lot of indicators that predict future economic growth, purchasing manager surveys and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
With the growth in e-commerce, are there some new indicators that have been recognized recently that we ought to be paying more attention to?
Before you hang up, you had a question that you emailed in, and it's not at top of brain. I was going to look it up, so give us that one too.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, enjoyed the bounce yesterday, is like everybody else, but I have heard that the run-up in the past, I don't know, couple of years has been largely, I'll call them the FANG stocks.
Ah,
If you, and the run-up and the severe drop was due to the FANG stocks, if you pull all of those FANG stocks out of the equation, how would the rise in the market be the same, or would they just piggyback off of that?
Okay.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, that's a great question.
Good. That, by the way, is an excellent, excellent, excellent observation and question. It's kind of like the bricks and the fangs. Anytime that you get, for whatever it's worth,
nicknames. Yeah.
Anytime you get nicknames, you should be afraid. By the way, this goes all the way back to the Nifty 50 in the early 20th century.
The dogs of the Dow. You just go through all the nicknames of the trendy thing, and basically, if it's already got a nickname, it's too late.
And from basically, it's nearly impossible to pull the FANG stocks out of the system and see what would have happened, because when a big chunk of the trading in the
let's explain what a FANG stock is for those that don't know what a FANG stock is. It's not a tooth any more than Bluetooth is actually a colored tooth. Fang.
Bluetooth is not a color tooth?
No, it should be. I would think that you would stick it in your mouth, but no, it goes in your ear instead.
It's named after a Danish Viking, but...
Right. this is a Bluetooth, and you put it in your ear. All right.
Maybe
so this...
he said stick it in your ear.
So Fang is the big tech stocks, and I think we need another name for them, maybe big data stocks. Apple
big,
definitely.
Big digital.
Big digital, big, because like Facebook doesn't actually sell technology. They sell subscriptions to a service.
Digital.
And they're digital.
Yeah, their product is totally digital.
Amazon. Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Google, which is now Alphabet, which the Google was the G in Fang, but now there's a two A's in Apple and Alphabet. So
it's actually Fan.
Fan. but we haven't changed the nickname, which
right.
tells you something. So this concept of how much of the run-up was because of that. Well, first off, let me say this. Indexes, except for the Dow Jones Industrial Average, are what's called capitally weighted. That means that the larger the company is, the more impact it has on the whole index. So if Apple is in the S&P 500, it is, and it is as big as it is. It is huge.
And it is.
It is. It was the first company to hit a $1 trillion valuation. That's a large valuation. It going up and down has a carry-on effect to the whole index because the index is just averaging these things together, but it gives more weight to the bigger companies. So it's the biggest company in the S&P 500 or is occasionally the biggest company in the S&P 500, which means that it has arguably the most important role in how we gauge that the S&P 500. It isn't the whole index. And when we look at the companies in that index, and we say this often, earnings in the S&P 500 were up for 2019 or 2018, 22%. 2018 was a whole year where earnings were up 22% mm-hmm. and the market was down 7%. When a big chunk of any reason for a down market is going to be big news on any corporation, if it's Walmart, if it's AT&T, if you go back a few years, or IBM, if you go back a few years, or Microsoft. So the index would move even if Apple wasn't in the index based on news on Apple.
Let's come back to that. We have a caller on 7. I want to come back to your two questions, by the way. I don't want to drop them, but we got a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. This question I have is a two-part question. There was been a while back that y'all made a statement regarding saying that y'all don't deal with anybody that, you know, wins the lottery. And the question is being as if, okay, if somebody did win the lottery and they came to y'all and said, look, I want to cooperate with y'all. I want to do the right thing. I want to work with y'all. Would y'all want to work with that person? Or you would just stand your ground and say, look, sir, we don't deal with people that win the lottery. You have a good day. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Well, if it's somebody that already had plans on investment, had already and were not acting erratically already, we would deal with it person by person. The reality is that most people that win the lottery do not do well with their winnings. And that's a understatement of extreme amounts. And most people that win the lottery become bankrupt.
The thing that we were trying to express about winning the lottery, if a person comes to us and they have a rational approach to their money and they want to make it last a long time and they want to follow what is reasonable historic evidence, we'll be glad to work with them. If a person comes to us and they think they're smarter than the market or they think their luck is really super good, and they believe in speculation and wild ideas, then we're going to no matter how much money they have. If they walked in the door with $100 million and said, I have these, I want to buy this stock, and this stock with my $100 million.
I'm going to go home and buy a whole bunch of houses and a whole bunch of cars.
Yep.
And we would definitely say no to that.
Tell them, no, it's been very nice meeting you, but would you please go and bankrupt yourself somewhere else?
Right. And here's the point. This is the big point. People tend to consider, well, go back another step. There's a definition for rich that I think you coined, but I love it. Rich means having more money than you know what to do with. So we all know rich people. They have more money than I know what to do with. But most successful people are not rich. They got to being as wealthy as they are by knowing what to do with their money. And if someone says, I am rich because I won the lottery, they have more money than they know what to do with, and there's like this psychological law that if you have more money than you know what to do with, unless you figure out what to do with it, unless you really seriously educate yourself, you'll eventually end up with as much money as you know what to do with, and sometimes that's a negative number.
Sometimes there are a lot of people who have no idea what to do with any amount of money, and they wind up broke.
Right. If somebody was living paycheck to paycheck before they won the lottery, it would be very, very difficult to change that habit after they won the lottery. And those are people that we would give advice to. And my advice in those cases would be to take the annuity that the state offers. Let them give you a check every month for the next 30 years and use that, because if you take the lump sum and you're used to living paycheck to paycheck, you're going to wind up living paycheck to paycheck again. And the numbers on that are, there's been a lot of study on this. There are just very, very few people that go from paycheck to paycheck to lottery winning that don't go bankrupt. People that are used to having an extra balance in their bank account that don't have a lot of debt and they win the lottery, the statistics look better on that. They're still not great, but they're better than the first case. If someone comes in and says, I'm not going to make any decisions on this stuff without full information, and I'm going to treat this like it is the ability for me to propel the success of myself and my offspring into the future for as many generations as is possible, we're going to talk to those people.
Getting back to the question from the previous caller about FANG stocks, about the digital high growth stocks that led the market towards particularly the last few years, the reason you can't separate out those stocks from the rest of the index to find out what would happen if they weren't there is because a large part of the trading that goes on in the market, not a large part of the ownership of the market, the S&P 500 funds constitute a large part of the trading. The S&P, I just read a really good article, the S&P 500 funds and ETFs actually own about 7.4% of the S&P 500. Well, that sounds insignificant until you realize most of the rest of the money in the S&P 500, nearly all of it, is managed accounts of some kind. In other words, pension funds and insurance portfolios and so on, and they don't trade very often, so they just kind of sit there and ride it out, make small long-term changes, pretty much the things that we do. The volatility in the market, though, is generated by a relatively small amount of the total market value, and a big chunk of that is emotionally generated by S&P 500 index funds. So when the index fund goes up, there is a powerful, and Jake mentioned the FANG stocks, the digital stocks, Facebook, led by Facebook, and then there's Google and Netflix and all of those in there. If you look at those and you realize that they are phenomenally overpriced, they're growth stocks that I say phenomenally overpriced. They are stocks with very, very high, in most cases, there's a couple of exceptions, price-to-earnings ratios, which means that they basically are trading with the expectation that they're going to grow massively into the future. As they move up, they take the index with them. And as the index moves up, people in their 401ks and in their S&P 500 index funds and in their ETFs S&P 500 ETFs tend to buy more because the market's up, which is really not too brilliant, but that's the way people do it.
Right.
And then...
you know, the old adage, buy high, sell low.
Right.
Right. That's the opposite of what you're really supposed to do, but
that's what people do. And then
when
they start down, and of course Apple has just taken a big hit because of China, and we're going to get into that. That's important. And when you see that the S&P 500, you watch the S&P 500 fund sales and purchases, or mutual fund sales and purchases in general, and in 401ks and so on, you realize that when the market starts down, the movement gets exacerbated by people who liquidate their S&P 500 index funds or ETFs in their retirement accounts. Now, the people who have them in regular accounts that are taxable have a far lower likelihood of liquidating because they would be hit with a big tax bill.
Right.
But the people who don't have any taxes to pay on it, and it's a free transaction, have a tendency to move in herds and stampede in one direction or the other.
This happens in 401ks. It happens in their retirement plans. People see the market's going down. They pull out of one position, and they say, I'm going to stick this over there. That's why the market goes down.
And by the way, anytime you hear somebody say the market is going, it doesn't make any difference whether up or down. They're wrong.
There is no going. That implies an ongoing activity. It is. There's an instant event that's going on at any moment.
And the Mississippi River is flowing south. Yes, absolutely, no doubt about it. That is ongoing.
Is going south.
And water is flowing downhill.
And it would be very, very hard for it to go the opposite way.
Right. But it always goes downhill. It's just sometimes downhill changes.
Right.
But the market is never going anywhere. It can turn on a dime. It doesn't. And there's a lot of momentum trading that goes on, whether you realize that or not. Momentum is, if it's going up, I'm going to buy some. If it's going down, I'm going to sell. And a lot of the program trading is based on, if the market went down, sell. If the market goes up, buy. And catch it before it goes up anymore. That, on a regular calm day, recently, relatively calm day, about 85% of the trades were either program trades or S&P 500 ETFs or index funds, which means that the big surges up and down that you've been seeing in the market recently are largely herd stampedes because they see something that they consider to be an indicator and they buy or sell on that.
And you can see this very, very clearly. All you have to do is look at what areas of the market are down. And at this point, and very easily, you look around and you say, well, all of them. If all of the market is down, it's because people are selling out of all of the market. And the easiest way to do that is if you own an index fund. And when we see the majority, you know, when we say all of the market down, there are a lot of extremely profitable companies out there. They're doing extremely well, and they've been sold as well as the ones that are not so profitable. When you own an index fund and you sell out of the index fund, they got to sell in proportion to the index. That doesn't say this is a good fund or this is a good stock and that's a bad stock. I'm going to sell the bad stock and keep the good one. It's just you sell them both.
John Bogle, who used to be the CEO and president,
founder
and chairman of Vanguard,
inventor of the index
fund, recently said there's too much money in index funds and index ETFs now.
Right.
And as a result,
it's the majority of money going into the market.
It's moving the market around in irrational ways. And he is concerned. He said the issue in having an index fund was to ride on the back of the analysts and the people who are looking carefully at these individual stocks and just ride on their backs and ride it through. And he said, but it's no longer that. It's now driving the analysts to do things. And he said this could come to an unhappy end, which we've been saying for many years.
This is another point I wanted to throw in here. I've gone back through different sources that I've kept from people communicating about the radio program. And I went back to 2005, and I was looking through some stuff there, and I heard from people, why are you guys so optimistic? And then 2006, why are you guys always so pessimistic? So coming out of the crash of 2000, we were saying this is way too low. This doesn't make sense. Then 2006, we started saying, hey, this whole mortgage area is not very sustainable. We were talking about collateralized mortgage obligations. We were calling them CMOs, and people didn't know what that meant. And we were saying, this is a scary thing, and this is a problem. And people were asking us, why are you so pessimistic? And then in 2009, they were asking us why we were always so optimistic. And for the past year, they've been asking us why we've been so pessimistic.
And
if you'll listen to us from last week and the week before and this week, you'll hear a very different tone from what we were talking about all of 2018, which is now that we've got this correction, we're not teetering on the edge of being a little bit overvalued or maybe fair market or where do we find the bargain. There's bargains everywhere right now. When I look at the market, it's full of companies with great earnings that are being valued way below what I would think anybody would consider fair market value, except that the market considers them fair at the current value, and that doesn't make sense to me.
Several analysts have come out who are the head of investment strategy at major investment banks, Citibank.
Yeah.
And others.
Bank of America.
And they seem, there's a pretty consistent number they're coming out with. 14 to 17% rise in the market is what they expect for 2019. Does that mean we're forecasting it? No.
These are the same people that are forecasting a 1.5% growth for the whole year and the GDP.
Maybe two.
Maybe two at the beginning of the year, at the end of the year ending at like 1.1.
Yeah,
so for average, right, about 1.5% GDP growth, and they're also saying we could get 14 to 17% upward in the market. Why? Because it's been so undervalued at this point. We're not predicting that kind of growth, but we are saying that it is undervalued.
Yeah, based on historic trends, the market, the S&P 500 stock index right now is about 17% below its long-term historic average price-to-earnings ratio.
Right.
And that means that if earnings go through as forecast by next year, and for next year, there's several organizations that do the forecast, and the S&P and the Standard & Poor's company combines them together and said, here is the consensus forecast for earnings for the S&P 500. And they've come out with a 7.8% rise. Now, last year was 22. This year, 7.8% rise in earnings. But there's a little caveat there. So the caveat is that's presuming that the 25% tariffs don't go into effect. If we put the 25% tariffs into effect, then it pretty much wipes out the earnings growth for next year or this year. And so the bet right now from these analysts, their estimate is that the president will not put into effect 25% tariffs. Well, there's also a 20% tariff or something on cars exported out of Europe. In other words, basically all the tariffs that are threatened, the market can't make up its mind with good cause. There's a struggle between the people say, no, he's not going to do that, and the people say he is going to do it. If the president does say we're going to do these tariffs, then a couple of things are pretty widely, there's a pretty good consensus, here's what will happen. Number one, U.S. earnings growth will drop to zero, which means that the market will rise. And number two, the Chinese will be in a world of hurt and probably go into a recession, which is really bad because we export a lot of stuff to China. But we have to get some commercials out of the way. It's about 11:45, or 10:45. It's 11:45 on the East Coast.
Yeah.
And this is KTEM, and you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number in here, 254-773-1400, and we're going to break for KTEM commercials. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
I have another subject real quick, if you don't mind.
Other than a dad joke?
Yeah, no dad jokes,
okay,
at the moment.
All right.
Lumber.
Lumber.
Yes. Are you aware of what's happened with lumber?
It's kind of lumbering along.
We spoke about the price of lumber throughout the first half of 2018. we had a record rise in the price of lumber, and it had to do with a series of issues. Well, number one was sanctions on Russia for invading Ukraine, which was a very, very good thing to do, the sanctions, not the invasion. That caused,
all depends on whether you're Russian.
Yeah, that caused Baltic birch plywood and a whole series of other Baltic area lumber to get stopped. And that was in 2017. Okay, roll forward through 18. I guess that was 16, 17. Through 2018, one of the very, very first tariffs that was implemented was against Canada on their soft pulp or soft wood lumber. And that's pine. It's basically, if you look at any 2x4, it's the thing that you use to build buildings in the United States, unless you're building it a much more expensive way. 2x4s are the lifeblood of the construction industry. And we got a lot of our 2x4s at that point from Canada. Well, we had a big tariff that got instituted on that, which immediately caused the price of lumber to start up. And then at the same time, we started having fires in California, and we had a lot of bug attacks in the central and Midwest. So it didn't look good. We had an absolutely all-time record-breaking upward movement in the price of lumber. And by all-time, I mean if you want to go all the way back to Greece, you can find a slightly more drastic upward movement in the price of lumber when they were building their fleets in Athens. So that caused the price of timber and lumber to go way up.
Yeah, but
that's the kind of movement that we had.
But the Bureau of Economic Analysis has not been able to look at that data directly.
Not, you know, no. They needed to send somebody back in time to Sparta, Greek warfare against Athens to figure out the exact numbers. And for some reason, they're reluctant to do that.
That's called the Peloponnesian Wars, by the way.
Yes. So come forward to today, we have this record-breaking rise in the price of lumber. There was a tiny event, an arbitration court with 12 judges on it, unanimously said that there was no strategic threat from importing soft lumber from Canada. So that opened that back up. That was midsummer. Same time in midsummer, across the southeast, they had a record harvest for pine. They went through and cut pine like crazy because the prices were so high. Come forward to today, lumber prices are at half of what they were at the peak.
Yeah. And a lot of people, by the way, who invested in alternative investments,
right,
very specifically, I mean, one-on-one in either
lumber
limited
producing
partnership or bought the land themselves and grew the pine themselves,
yeah,
and were dependent upon that for their retirement, are suddenly realizing that they're selling their wood for less than it cost them to grow it.
Right. And I have clients that sold a lot of timber this year. Clients that sold in May, they sold a lot of timber and made a lot of money. We're able to invest that elsewhere. There's another aspect here in that the rising interest rates mean that mortgage prices are getting more expensive. Their month-by-month prices are more expensive, which slowed the housing market, which meant the demand for lumber dropped right as this massive supply showed up. So if you've been putting off a home improvement project because of the cost of lumber, check out Home Depot, check out Lowe's. You're going to find prices that will make you smile.
The lumber price at Lowe is low.
Yes. Lowe's. Lowe's Home Depot.
Low, yes.
Yeah.
And Home
All
Depot,
right,
too.
So, caller, we have a caller on 773-1400.
Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
And that's
that
same
was that
caller.
Same caller,
again.
Yeah.
That beep beeper.
There's we subscribe to Moody's Analytics, economy.com. And you're certainly welcome to do so, too, but it costs a bunch. By the way, the good data, I hate to tell you this, but the really good stuff, you got to pay for. And
yeah,
it's generally in the hundreds of dollars a year, sometimes higher.
Sometimes in the thousands of dollars a year, and sometimes in the tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
And I wanted to give Mark Zandi's forecast, which he issued on January 2nd for 2019. And I want to point out that Mark Zandi, the head of economy.com, Moody's Analytics, was the guy who most accurately called the 2007 through 9 recession in advance. He forecasted, testified before Congress, and said it's coming. Everybody laughed at him, but he tends to be very correct. He said, we are in the virtuous part of the business cycle, with record job openings and bigger paychecks lifting consumer spending, fiscal stimulus and ample credit are fueling the virtuous cycle. Number two, the economy is vulnerable to major shocks and policy missteps, and President Trump's trade war could be both. Brexit and other geopolitical events also threaten to overrun the economy in coming months. And finally, while investors and many business leaders seem to expect a recession in the next year, we think that recession risk will be much higher early in the next decade, meaning 2020.
Yeah, and that's we've been saying, you know, beginning of last year, we were saying, look at the end of 2019, beginning of 2020. We really haven't revised that. It's mostly we're thinking it's likely to be 2020, but that means at the end of this year, we might start to see the market forecasting it. And what it's forecasting right now is uncertainty. And it's an easy forecast because it's happening right now.
And again, we said this at the beginning of the hour, as we're coming to the end of the hour, I want to say this again. Major bear markets, which is what I think everybody's afraid of right now, start when the market continues up after the economy has turned downward. Corrections happen when the economy is continuing to run along very nicely and fear of some future event that may or may not happen causes the market to drop between 10 and 20%, which is what I think we're seeing right now.
Yeah, and there, John Templeton's quote is one that I'm going to remind everyone again. This is a quote about bull markets. That's the upward moving ones. Bull markets are born on pessimism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria.
We're mature.
Yeah. If you look around right now, do you see any euphoria?
None.
Do you see a lot of pessimism?
Yes.
We had some optimism going before the correction. That's what had us worried. We're worried about people being optimistic. We're generally the ones that people are asking, why are you so optimistic when everybody else is being pessimistic? So when everybody's being optimistic and we start warning and people say, why are you being so pessimistic? It's because we're starting to see the maturity forming in that bull market, mature on optimism. Well, now we have a lot of pessimism, which may help us get all the way through 2019 without an actual bear. That's the thing, is that this psychology, shake out enough of the people that are willing to run away from the market based on fear, and you can prolong the time before an actual problem happens that will cause people to run out of the market based on fear.
I'm going to go out on a bit of a limb, and I'm not the only person making this prediction, but I think there's a very high probability this is a head fake. We'll come out of this dip, surge forward to a very, very good year, particularly early in 2019, and people are going to say, see, we have nothing to worry about, and then it's when you're going to see the bull run away and there will be unreasonable optimism. When you see that unreasonable optimism, thinking that, okay, this worked out really well in the past, that we didn't have a recession when the market dipped. I bought in the market dip and made a lot of money, and then people will see they made a lot of money. When you see that big surge upward with everybody agreeing that we've got this situation under control, no problems, that's when it's time to get worried. And we're out of time for the first hour. You are listening to The Personal Wealth Coach, which is a radio program produced and run by the company by the same name that is a registered investment advisory firm that helps people of higher net worth manage their wealth.
Yeah.
Which is why it's called The Personal Wealth Coach.
Doing it in a fiduciary way. You'd like to call us off the air,
we are at 254-947-1111.
Or you can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. There you'll find our newsletter, our podcasts from the radio program. You can also email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, and we do read those and try to answer them on the air. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.